Our course is titled Defending Constantine. Constantine was an emperor, ruled from AD 72 through 337. He was alive from 272 to 337, ruled Rome from 306 to 337. Not at first a united Rome. He did unite Rome in 324, united East and West. Today's lesson is Seeds of Evangelical Law and Justice for All. Some key questions we're looking at as the entire course is the realm of politics and civil government an area for which Christians are to seek redemption in Christ, and we're going to address that today. Must redemption in the area of politics and civil government be characterized by perfection, either initially or in the period prior to the second advent of Jesus? Specific questions for these two chapters. Did Constantine's imperial legislation have the effect of incorporating Christian principles into law? The answer we'll see is most likely not explicitly, and he did so imperfectly. And is the evangelization of law at all threatening? And the answer, of course, we believe is no. Some background into the sacrificial system of Rome. Leihart spends a lot of time here to give us a perspective on what Constantine was facing in ending gladiatorial games. The games were a religious sacrifice. They're based in the legend of, good morning, Marcus Curtis and the Curtain Lake named after him. In the middle of ancient Rome, in the middle of the ancient Forum, there was a pond. And according to legend, it had opened up, a chasm had opened up. The gods were not pleased. And Romans had brought all sorts of treasures and thrown them in there to appease the gods, and nothing worked, and the chasm threatened to destroy all of Rome. Mr. Marcus Curtis came, and he donned his armor, got on his horse, and he said, the best thing that Rome is known for are its soldiers and their sacrifice. And on that note, he rode his horse in the chasm. People threw treasures on top of him to honor him. It appeased the gods, and the chasm closed, and Rome was saved. So it was self-sacrifice that established the religious the religiosity of the gladiatorial games. In ancient Rome, suicide was just as honorable, an escape from illness, tyranny, shame, or slavery. Ancient Romans sacrificed captives or incorrigible slaves at funerals, but for the aristocrats, that became too barbaric, and eventually men were trained and armed so they might learn to die. The gladiatorial games became a reenactment of sacrifice of Remus by Romulus as the brother who must be slain that an empire be founded. There were two brothers who founded Rome. They built a wall around Rome to separate it from the rest of the world. And Remus jumped over the wall. And Romulus sacrificed his brother so that Rome might be preserved. The gladiatorial games were also political. The emperor was seated prominently as editor, which means he was the master of review, and decided the fate of the fighters. His presence was an expression of power. It gave the emperor the opportunity to display the common touch, much like presidents now who roll their sleeves up, take their ties off, roll their sleeves up to participate in community projects. The games gave the emperor that appeal to the common man. It provided one of the few opportunities for the people to voice their grievances. Chants could be heard about oppressive taxes. You know, it was this one opportunity where people were on equal level with the emperor. It was also an instrument of imperial power in the provinces. It was the Roman ideal. If the state, to quote Cicero, has come to its moment of truth, let us do as the worthy gladiators do, to die with honor, Let us, leaders of all peoples, fall with dignity rather than submit with shame. The games also had philosophical meaning. Here's a quote by Seneca. The gladiator considers it a disgrace to be matched with an inferior and knows that he who has conquered without danger has conquered without glory. Fortune does the same. She seeks out the bravest for her opponents and passes over some with contempt. She attacks the most unyielding and upright against whom she may exert her strength. She tried Mucius by fire. He was a trained assassin, and he was caught, and he stuck his hand into a fire to purify himself. He did this on his own. Fabricius by poverty, he could not be tempted or bribed, so he was a very poor. He was not a wealthy member of society. Rutilius by exile, Rutilius was a politician. He was a champion of the common man. He was a lawyer, and he fought for reforms against corruption in the bureaucracy of Rome, and he was eventually accused of corruption himself, and he was exiled. But he was asked to come back to Rome because he was so popular, and he refused. Regulus by tortures, he was a hero. It was this during the war with Carthage. He was captured, and he was sent back to Rome by Carthage to settle the dispute, and he honored his ransom by returning back to Carthage, and he was tortured to death. Socrates, we know who Socrates was, and Cato by death. Cato attempted to commit suicide when he rebelled against Julius Caesar. He was an old-fashioned Republican, so to speak, and he would rather commit suicide than live under imperial tyranny. He failed at his attempt to commit suicide, and his intestines spilled down on the floor. When people came to minister to him to save his life, he said no, and he finished the job himself by his own hand. And Seneca finishes up by saying, misfortune alone reveals great examples. To the philosopher, the games encourage the fundamentals of Roman citizenship: courage, patriotism, and self-sacrifice. So Constantine is coming to power where blood sacrifice represents Rome. It could not function without sacrifice. When Christians were thrown into the arena, they were doing what they were supposed to do. They were appeasing the gods. The Christians who believed in rendering to God the things that are God's and Caesar to Caesar were usurping the order that was Rome. So Christians saw the arena as martyrdom. To Rome, they saw it as appropriate form of worship. And that's what Constantine is coming to power in. In 325, Constantine declared that bloody spectacles are not suitable for civil ease and domestic quiet. There's some debate as to whether or not this actually was a decree to end the games, but it was followed up with that punishment would be met out by not shedding blood. Criminals were to be sent to the mines or to be enslaved in some other means, but the shedding of blood as sacrifice in the arena was ended by the time of Constantine. It's interesting to note that there was no arena in Constantinople. Constantine made no edicts concerning spectacles with beasts or to end the games themselves, but it was not to be used as a punishment. And by the end of the 4th century, all arena spectacles had ended. The shows were as basic to Rome as sacrifice. Rome was the arena, and the arena was Rome. And what would the empire be without it? It's interesting to note that some of Constantine's critics actually don't give him credit for ending the arena system. You know, it was great that he legitimized Christianity. It gave them their voice and their say. But Whitehart could not find any references to giving Constantine credit for ending that system. I mean, that's a big deal. Just as our the founding fathers of America, when they wrote the Constitution, said, "We the people," the first time in history that the people, the consent, were governed by the consent of the governed, Constantine was removing blood sacrifice from the political order. It was mind-boggling to his contemporaries. Was Constantine a Christian legislator? Excuse me. His decrees were not explicitly founded on Christian principles, but the tone of them certainly did apply. He legitimized Christianity. He extended exemptions to the church. He established Sunday. He was the first one to decree Sunday as a day of rest throughout the Roman Empire. And he celebrated a Sunday in his palace with Christian worship. He abolished crucifixion and torture that would scar the face. And Constantine did say that man was made in the image of God, and so therefore it was inappropriate to torture people and scar their face. He didn't say it was not wrong to torture people, but don't touch the face.
He was a heathen at heart.
Celibates and the childless were granted property rights. Before that, if you weren't married and didn't have heirs, you had no property rights. Constantine, for the first time, extended this to people who were chosen celibates or they were unmarried. Women were granted property rights and the right of divorce for women was strengthened. Before, women didn't have the right to divorce. They now had the right to divorce. They could divorce for reasons of if their husband was a murderer, if he caused an abortion, and also, I believe, defrauding her. So if she had property and she was defrauded, she could sue for divorce. And Constantine appears to be the first to legislate against rape and severely. He was very... sexual crimes were punished severely in Constantine's court. I think it has a lot to do with the controversy surrounding his wife and son. And he forbade married men to have concubines. So there is some Christian influence here. He also reformed inheritance law. Reformed tax collection, serfs had the right to appeal burdensome tax assessments and extortion. Corrupt bureaucrats had their hands cut off. And domesticated animals were not to be abused. This is the first time in history that domesticated animals were not to be abused outside of Jewish tradition. And guilty ranked soldiers were to be deported if they were to beat their horse. They could use a whip, but they could not use, they used to use clubs to beat their animals. And Constantine frowned upon that. He did have exercise brutality in his punishments, though. Rapists were burned alive with no appeal. Nope. Elopers could be burned alive as well, and their conspirators had boiling lead poured down their throats.
Is that where lead poisoning comes from?
Yes, you could probably get it that way. Informers were strangled by hand, and their tongues were cut out. And other offenders could be tied in a sack with snakes and thrown into a river to drown. That was actually abolished, and Constantine reinstituted that punishment. And that punishment was reserved for people who abuse children, where they abandoned them, left them out to die. His legislation was more of a moral exhortation than an actual code. He showed disgust for sexual criminals, informants, and corrupt bureaucrats. Although the death penalties did not increase until after Constantine. It's noted by Eusebius that Constantine was so worried about shedding blood unnecessarily that he was lax in his punishments, even in the controversy surrounding the death of his wife and son. There's evidence, or there's cause that he did not actually execute them. He actually showed mercy, but they ended up dying as it was.
Now, is this stuff all fairly new punishments that were instated under Constantine, or is this stuff that kind of existed and kind of just kind of pushed to the forefront?
Well, there's a system of corruption in Rome. Rome was corrupt. It didn't become corrupt. Corruption was the norm.
A lot of this punishments focus more to like sexual criminals, to children, stuff like that. Had that existed prior?
There was hardly any punishment at all other than adultery in Rome for sexual crimes, what we perceive as sexual crimes. They weren't sexual. If we think our culture is... causes us to blush. If we were to step in Rome prior to Constantine, it would blow our minds. I mean, nasty business was going on everywhere. It was part of their religious worship as well.
Yeah. And obviously, this is more of a favor towards the Christian side and perspective. Is there any historical data as to after his installment with this sort of punishment, is there data that indicates that some of this stuff, there was a decline in these areas, sexual
death penalty after Constantine? Death penalties did increase,
but
related to these,
with that curving the sexual criminals and things like that.
Leichhardt doesn't cite specific statistics.
Yeah.
But there certainly was a change in the culture.
Yeah.
Christians were only 10 to 15% of the population when Constantine came in. And then, by his laws, his legislation, it did Christianize the Roman culture, whether it was explicitly stated or not in his reasons for passing these laws. And we'll see how he does this. Constantine's legislation is frequently driven by a concern to protect the rights of the forgotten little people of the empire. I think he took his Christianity seriously. And why would Constantine have to explicitly state or quote chapter and verse from the Bible for his legislation? He was the leading political, he was the source of law in Rome. So his Christianity was a given. He is going to legislate his personal beliefs. And I think that irritates a lot of his critics. They criticize Constantine for not citing specific biblical law. But why would he have to? If he is a legitimate Christian, why would he have to cite chapter and verse? A lot of his reasons for his legislation were thrown out when it was codified, because emperors, when they would legislate, they would give reason as to why they're legislating, and a lot of that was left out when it was codified by a couple of emperors later. Prior to Constantine, Roman governors were advised to practice law as the circumstances required. They could judge based on the mood of the people in their province. If the circumstances required that a bribe was put in their pocket, they judged accordingly. being a judge or a provincial governor, it was a means to advance themselves. It was a very corrupt system. Corruption was not a flaw in the system, it was the system. And many martyrs were made because judges thought sacrificing a few Christians was a small price to pay to keep the province peaceful and quiet. Constantine issued 25 laws reforming the process of appeals. Constantine fumed against fees and a system that worked against the poor who could not pay for justice. Appeals were pay-based. Every time, if you lost a court case, and every time, and if you wanted to appeal, you had to pay. You had to pay the court. You had to pay the a solicitor if you had, if you had to hire one. You had to bribe him to take your side in the case. If you wanted to win, you had to bribe the judge. This is a quote from Constantine. The chamber curtain of the judges shall not be venal. Entrance shall not be gained by purchase. The private council shall not be infamous on account of bids, and the appearance of governors shall not be at a price. You often had to pay the governor just to show up to hear your case. And it was an expensive process because you had to travel to him, you had to wait for him, and you actually had to pay him to make an appearance. And Constantine further stated, the ears of the judge shall be open equally to the poorest as well as to the rich. If anything unjust was taken, again Constantine warned that armed punishment will be at hand, which will cut off the heads and necks of the scoundrels. Not just the head, but also the neck. I guess it didn't go far enough.
Well, I can see why he had to do that, because I'm sure these judges, and if they had done this all this time, they probably hated him for this proclamation.
And he was,
so he had to be very severe with his.
He was changing a whole entire political order.
Right.
Not just the religion of Rome, but the whole entire political order in doing so. How it functioned. It's important to note the object of his attack and who is being defended. He's attacking corrupt judges, politicians, bureaucrats, and he's defending the poor. That had never been done before. They were always taken advantage and oppressed. And that in itself is a Christian principle. The most significant change came in 323. The right of litigants to appeal from the civil courts to the courts of bishops. That's right, Constantine used the church to serve the poor, and he used them as actual courts to settle civil cases. He gives no specifics to an agenda. Did Constantine have a Christian agenda? He doesn't say. But he does say that he wanted to curb the wicked seeds of litigation so that the wretched men entangled in long and nearly endless snares of legal procedure may have a timely release from the mischief pleadings or absurd love of disputatio. Is that correct, John?
That sounds right.
Okay. It's a legal word. To ask a lawyer. Bishops sped up the process because they generally issued rulings after one hearing. According to Constantine, the bishop's voice was the voice of God. And it was free and open to not only Christians, but to Jews and the pagans as well. Anybody could go to the court of the bishops. And you didn't have to bribe a bishop either. They were of a much better character.
They really were.
I had a thought on that, and I lost it. It escaped me.
Welcome to getting old. Mm.
It sounded really good in my head. He made reforms in treatments of outcasts, and slaves. Outcasts were literally outcasts. They were children, either infants or young children, if you couldn't take care of them through poverty, or if they were deformed, or if you were just had a superstitious belief, you could leave your child out for exposure. It was a principle of Roman law. You can actually look that up. 12 tables, number 4. Children could be exposed to ailments because of deformity, illegitimacy, poverty, superstition. But what's interesting is that there was no formal prohibition until 374. Although Constantine did undermine the basis of that, he punished parricide, which is the murder of a relative. It was a son. Son, uncle, cousins, if they were murdered, that's where you were. So even children, I guess, could fall under in that category. That's where you were tied in this in a sack with snakes and thrown into a river or the sea. In 322, he offered imperial aid to parents who couldn't afford to have children. It's interesting to note that it's not cited, Leichhardt doesn't cite that abortion was illegal, but I couldn't find any reference to abortion as commonplace in Rome. So if you became pregnant, you had the child. Although abortion did happen, but as was it legislated against, I couldn't find a reference to it. But he did. Constantine did offer imperial aid to parents who cannot afford their children. Constantine also decreed that parents of a foundling could determine the slave or free status of their adoptive child. So, if they were left at the forum, or if they were left on the steps of a church, people could adopt them, or they could enslave them. So he didn't. Constantine didn't ban slavery outright. But what this is it's said that Constantine used this to undermine the slave system by making parents aware that their children could be enslaved, because slavery was not looked well upon. It was used, but to be a slave was lower than human. Constantine is often criticized for not simply abolishing slavery. Slaves were considered personae. I looked that up, and what that means is they're an actual extension of yourself. As if a tool was an extension of your hand, a slave was also an extension of yourself. There's also reasons as to why Constantine probably didn't abolish slavery right away. It was because it was such an integral part of Roman society. You couldn't sell a slave if they were a tutor, because it would separate the teaching from children. So there was continuity there. He tried to keep families together. So if you were to sell a slave and they had family, the whole family got shipped out with him. And also, the church had not yet developed a consensus on slavery at that time. Some in the church at the time believed that physical slavery was akin to religious slavery. You were a slave to sin, and then were redeemed out of it. So, and the slaves were welcome in the church. They were treated as equals in the church. So there was no social status in the church in regard to slaves. In 321, manumission, which is the freeing of slaves, it's a legal process, before a bishop, had the same legal force as granting of Roman citizenship and endorsed as an act of piety. He's legitimizing the church's authority in freeing people from slavery. No price had to be paid to do this. You go before a bishop and you announce that your slaves were free as an act of piety, so it's an act of worship. And those slaves were granted Roman citizenship. Constantine also appointed numerous new senators to water down the gentry class. He wants to get rid of corrupt politicians, so he's appointing new people. He promoted many from the lower classes, which had the highest concentration of Christians. He appointed a Christian as a chief magistrate in Rome at a time when Rome still had its form and its pagan senators. The mayor of Rome, so to speak, was appointed by Constantine. He was a Christian. He was from Spain. Bishops formed courts of appeal. And Constantine also appointed committees to distribute funds and building projects. And as we know, he really liked to build churches. By supporting the church and empowering the bishops, Constantine was creating a Christian governing class. Eusebius seems enthusiastic in Constantine's anxiety to avoid wanton sacrifice of human life. He found in Constantine a political expression of Jesus' exhortation to love one's enemies. But doubts are raised by his critics because the execution of Faustus and Crispus, Faustus his wife and Crispus his son. Faustus was Crispus's stepmother. Was it political that they were executed, or were they guilty of adultery? If they were guilty of adultery, was he not justified in having them executed? The answer is, by Roman law and even by biblical standard, yes, they could have been executed. But there's also doubt as to whether or not he actually had them executed. There's whether or not Crispus seduced Faustus or she seduced him. It was consensual or it was forced. There's historically, it's not settled. But she did become pregnant. Crispus was sentenced to exile, but he was poisoned. If we remember back in our Roman ideal, to take one's life in self-sacrifice was a higher ideal than being executed. So it's possible that he actually poisoned himself. And it's said that Constantine created a hot bath and basically Faustus boiled to death, but it's noted that she bled to death in the bath. So it's possible that he encouraged her to have an abortion, and hot baths were used as a means for abortion. She might have died from that.
I guess I'm a little confused about that issue. If she became pregnant and she was married to him, isn't that enough evidence to show that she committed adultery?
Yes.
Well, what's the...
The Constantine's critics just think he's a bad guy because of that. They wanted to delegitimize his conversion by this example. But this also could speak to Constantine's obsession of laws regarding marriage and sex. A lot of his punishments in regards to marriage law and sexual crimes, as we saw, they were punished by fire, being burned alive. So it seems that he was trying to purify Roman culture by punishing those who committed such crimes. And evangelical law, was Constantine's attempt to, was he trying to evangelize the legal system in Rome? And I couldn't sum it up any better than Lightheart here. Canon law was far from perfect, but it set the standard of justice that civil law and rulers were to exhort to emulate, and founded the Western legal tradition until recently. I think I misquoted that. It doesn't sound good right now.
It doesn't sound good at all.
No, it doesn't. I have it right here.
In fact, if that's his quote,
Canon law was far from perfect, but it set a standard of justice that civil rulers were exhorted to emulate, and that founded the Western legal tradition until recently, our time, when the religious foundations of Western law have been severely eroded. So Constantine's legislation gave us our foundations of Western legal tradition. This idea of separation of church and state. I have a quote by Cardinal Ratzinger that speaks to when Christ said, render things to Caesar to the Caesars and to God to God. And Constantine embodied this. Constantine was separating the sacrificial system from the political order. He was promoting the church in the legal system. I mean, these bishops did apply biblical principles in their rulings. And it appealed to Constantine because, number one, it was efficient, and it was just. And Leichhardt states, so who do we have to thank for our Western legal tradition? And he states that we should thank Constantine for this, in establishing these principles that we enjoy today. Cardinal Ratzinger, who became Pope, said that the freedoms we enjoy today came out of this, separation of the church and the sacred and the political. In conclusion, critics state Constantine squandered the opportunity to promote religious liberty and increase respect for human life and dignity. Can we really expect Constantine to become Abraham Lincoln upon his conversion, to emancipate slaves overnight, just as much as James Madison did when he wrote the Constitution? To Yoder, had Constantine's faith been stronger, and this is a quote, he would be just as free as anyone else to take the risks in faith. But yet he also stipulates that that no one had ever had to deal with a state as such. In other words, it was so corrupt that Constantine was, there was no system that to history that Constantine had to deal with yet. So he didn't have anything to base his rulings on other than what? I think his own Christian principles. Yet he's criticized for this. To Yoder, to Christians, there can only be a polarity between Caesar and the God of the Bible. In the Mennonite tradition, Christians do not go into politics. They're conscious objectors when it comes to war. To the Mennonites and to Anabaptists, Christianity is political, being political. So you don't have to go into politics. But from the beginning, the Christians acknowledged that the state had a role in protecting the innocent and punishing the wicked. So what would good government look like? A Roman Empire that, to Yoder, would not persecute Christians, in which they would have their say and rights, in which the laws could be judged from their perspective. So even according to Yoder's standard, it would have looked a lot like the government that Constantine established in this editorial's mind. It's like, and what's wrong with that? So can we answer that question? Did Constantine use Christian principles to legislate? And it's apparent that he did. Any questions?
I just wanted to make a couple short comments. You mentioned early on that Constantine couldn't cite scripture in defense of some of his...
Not that he couldn't,
but that he
didn't.
Right, and I think it's important to note that at that time, the Bible didn't exist as canonized scripture. It was separated in different documents and different fragments among the churches. So there was no chapter verse structure within the Bible to quote from, even if he wanted to. And so he had to cite Christian tradition as opposed to scripture, because the tradition was known among the Christians, among the bishops, but to actually quote a chapter and verse, it didn't exist. That came later.
That's correct. And canon law was applied differently in different regions of the empire as well.
Yeah. Well, because the churches were autocephalous, so in Antioch they had different canon law than in Alexandria or in Jerusalem.
Correct.
Right? And then my second point would be on the issue of slavery. The the letter from St. Paul to Philemon is a good example of sort of the Christian perspective on slavery. We had to honor the fact that Philemon had a slave, but Paul was very quick to say, you know, Paul, through Christ, was able to liberate Philemon from his slavery to sin, so should not Philemon do the same thing for his own slave? And I think that was how we were supposed to, or at least Constantine was supposed to, address slavery, through changing the hearts and the culture rather than just the law.
That, yes, and Leichhardt does cite that, does cite Philemon. And he says that as the culture was Christianized through the Court of Appeals by the bishops, by his legislation, by the separate, by the ending of the sacrificial system in Rome, that slavery would end. I think in our political system, in the writing of our Constitution, there was certainly the same debate going on. It's also interesting to note that if you, to Constantine, if you murdered a slave, you killed a slave, you were executed. There was very sexual crimes and crimes against slavery, against slaves, were meted out justly by Constantine. But the slave system did eventually end by, I think, two emperors later.
Can I actually say one other thing?
Go right ahead.
On the issue of the bishops, you had mentioned that they were sort of impervious to bribery and so forth, and I heard a little laughter, but the thing is, these were the guys that were so persecuted under the pagan emperors. You know, they really lived out their faith. They really had Christ within them. These were people who were very much monastic, so they really practiced sort of self-denial, you know, for the faith and for Christ. These were people who, I think they were quite impervious to bribery. And that's why they could be trusted in issues of court.
Well, Constantine did certainly treat them very well. So they were given social status as bishops. I believe there's even an instance where a slave did become a leader in the church. If he was a bishop or not, well, Leichhardt didn't say. But they were given ranking status as bishops. So they were treated well. But you're right, coming out of persecution, they had every reason to buck the old order. And they didn't always get along. The bishops didn't always get along. They were not perfect men. But they were certainly, according to Constantine, a much better alternative than what he had to deal with. Eric, do you want to close us in prayer?
Today, prepare us for the worship service ahead. Be with our fellowship time. Thank you for Chris and his time that he put in for this.
Amen.